It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Bickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at what the government is and isn't able to do to protect Americans from outbreaks of bacteria like salmonella in chicken.
But first, news broke yesterday that for the first time ever, millennials outnumber Gen Xers in the workplace.
As the country faces issues like climate change, widening income inequality, and a growing partisan divide, the attitudes of millennials will become increasingly important.
Harvard University's Institute of Politics recently took a look at attitudes in the millennial generation. Millennial is defined as people between the ages of 18 and 29 years of age. Here to sort through the results is Ellen Robo. She's the student chair of the Harvard Public Opinion Project, which just released its 27th poll surveying young Americans. Ellen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, Ellen, why do you think it's important to know what young Americans are thinking and how they feel about issues of the day?
I think you mentioned it earlier. The number of millennials that will vote in the 2016 election is predicted to be larger than the baby boomers that are going to be voting.
And the millennial generation. Mm-hmm. The millennial generation has been written about a lot, discussed a lot, not always positive coverage. How do you think polls like yours contribute to the complete picture of who millennials really are?
I think our poll, which is slightly different than other polls that are done on millennials, is written by millennials. So it's a group of students in conjunction with the IOP, the Institute of Politics Director of Polling. And so I think it gets at some of the issues that are important to millennials that are not necessarily important to other age groups, like student debt. So I think it paints a fuller picture.
Well, I want to start with some issues of race and justice, issues of policing, because these are very relevant in the nation at large and certainly here in Wisconsin today. Some of the questions that you asked in this thread were new to the poll this year. What did you ask?
Yes. So we, in light of all of the current events going on in this area, asked about whether our age group, which is 18 to 29-year-olds, feel that the criminal justice system is capable of judging fairly without bias due to race or ethnicity. And a startling percent of this age group did not feel that way. So almost 50% of the entire population did not feel that the criminal justice system could judge without bias. And that number goes up to 2/3 if you look at young Black Americans.
And in terms of trust in police, what did you find there?
So we found that across, if you look at the entire age group, the trust in police is one of the highest that we ask, but this is very divided across race. So 1/3 of young Black Americans never trust their local police department to do the right thing. Which is a startling number. 1/3, 1 in 3 Black men do not believe that Black Americans do not believe the police do the right thing.
This is an interesting finding here on a couple of counts, and one is that the suggestion has been made that the millennial generation has possibly come of age in a post-racial era. Now, based on your findings, what do you think about that idea?
Our numbers, as much as we would like that to be true, our numbers are not showing that. So we asked, in our poll, we asked whether respondents supported the Black Lives Matter protests, and there was a huge racial divide. So 81% of young Black Americans supported the protest, whereas only 37% of young white Americans supported the protest.
And did you ask also if respondents thought that the protests would be effective?
Yes, we did. And in both cases, and actually across all groups, whether they thought they would bring meaningful change lagged significantly behind whether they supported them. So for young Black Americans, 60% believe that they'll bring meaningful change, whereas only 29% of young white Americans believe they'll be effective in change.
So those are some real fault lines between Black Americans and white Americans in attitudes about police and justice. Are all of these questions new, or is this sort of a trend that you've seen just this year?
So Unfortunately, for tracking purposes, we've not asked these questions before. We have seen some shifts in some other areas in questions that we do ask every year. So we have a section of questions that try to get at cynicism and apathy within the political system. So whether you believe your vote makes a difference, whether you believe people like you are able to change politics. And so we had several of those questions where there was a remarkable shift, an 8-point shift in young Black Americans believing that they had more of a say in government, which is an interesting result of all of the media attention and political attention that's been brought to this issue in the last year.
We're talking right now with Ellen Robo. She's the student chair of the Harvard Public Opinion Project, just released its 27th poll surveying young Americans, millennials in this case. We're talking about that new polling and how millennials feel about policing, sexual assault, and major institutions like Wall Street, the federal government, and Congress. And I want to move on now to look at issues of trust. Now, you asked about a big array of longtime institutions, Wall Street, the government, the military. Broadly speaking, how trusting are millennials in these big, longstanding public institutions?
So millennials are not very trusting in large institutions, but as a ray of optimism, they are more trusting in the last year across every institution that we've asked about. Has either stayed the same or gone up in trust, with major federal institutions going up the most. So Obama, Congress, the federal government saw the biggest shift, the biggest positive change.
That's an interesting one. So I know that that's not necessarily the mission of your poll, but have you hazarded a guess on why that might be?
We have. And so, as you mentioned, this is somewhat speculation because we don't ask about it. We saw a big shift, a 7-point shift in the approval of Obama in his job performance in terms of the economy. And there was a much larger shift in that than his approval rating. We speculate that having the economy do better means that people are more trusting of the federal government and these larger institutions, whereas state governments, local governments, the media, Wall Street did not change that much.
And there were a couple spikes of trust there that seemed noteworthy. One was in scientists and another the military. It seems as though there is more trust to be found in those two.
Yes. So the military tends to be high. We've asked that one for many years. We added scientists this year to our list of institutions, partially because we asked some other questions about science policy. And both of those, more than 50%, the only two that more than 50% trusted the institution.
And what do you make of that? What do you make of that?
We've found that millennials tend to be very trusting of the military. Part of the increase in that in the last year might be to some of the other shifts we've seen in foreign policy and sort of military intervention abroad that we've seen. We've seen that millennials are more interested in military intervention abroad. I'm not sure if it's a chicken or the egg, if they're more interested because they trust the military more, or because of everything happening in the world, they are more trusting of the military.
Well, if you look at, say, the baby boomer generation came of age with the Vietnam War, the millennials coming of age around September 11th, that being a formative event, do you think that had anything to do with it?
I do. So I think September 11th, we poll 18 to 29-year-olds with part of the millennials, the sort of 30 to 35 number have aged out of our poll. And we've found that the younger part of the age group that we look at has become slightly more conservative. And this is a group of people who came of age during the recession and not necessarily September 11th, because I think the older half, the 24 to 29, and then even the 30 to 35-year-olds, came of age with the Iraq and Afghanistan wars and the U.S. intervention abroad in that situation, in those situations, and are slightly less in favor of military intervention, whereas this younger group, the 18 to 24-year-olds, did not experience that and are now seeing ISIS and some of the other radical Muslim groups that are really harnessing social media in a way that I think has negatively connected with that age group.
And we leave it there. Ellen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ellen Rovo is the student chair of the Harvard Public Opinion Project, which just released its 27th poll surveying young Americans.
As the law stands today, the presence of salmonella bacteria is just part of the reality of consuming poultry in the United States. That's because the bacteria is not considered an adulterant by the FDA. Its presence in chicken, even its role in an outbreak, doesn't necessarily spark a recall.
The issue is at the center of a new Frontline documentary called The Trouble with Chicken. Documentary filmmaker David Hoffman tells the story of the largest salmonella outbreak linked to chicken in U.S. history and how it was allowed to spread around the country despite evidence that it was linked to foster farms in the Pacific Northwest. This is Oregon State epidemiologist speaking.
One of the things that's happened in the United States around food and food production is that it has gotten a lot bigger and more industrial. So whereas 50 years ago we might have seen outbreaks that happen, they would be relatively local. Now when we see outbreaks, we often see cases that are in many, many different states. So I think not only the scale of production, but the scale of distribution has meant that if some product is contaminated, it has the potential for affecting much broader number of people in a much broader geographic area.
Clip from the Frontline documentary, The Trouble with Chicken. It airs tonight at 9 on your local public TV station. David Hoffman joins us now. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, David, let's start with that point we just heard. Salmonella in one production facility anywhere in the country can lead to a disease outbreak anywhere else in the country. Does that make it hard to track? And does it make it hard to tell a story like this?
It does. Rob, the agency that oversees this is the Agriculture Department. And they have inspectors on all these plants. But the people that track illness are the state public health departments. And what happened in this particular case was a very big outbreak in Oregon, Washington, and California. Over 600 people were sickened. And this wasn't your typical potluck supper that went bad, you know, a one-time illness where people recovered. This rolled on for more than a year. People kept coming to hospitals with this particular salmonella infection. And the public health officials are like detectives. They had to figure out, where is this coming from? Because before you can do anything, you got to pinpoint it.
Now, tell us a little bit about salmonella. I learned from watching this, salmonella means a lot of different things. There are some fairly, not benign, but non-particularly harmful varieties. And then there are much more dangerous ones that can be spread on chicken and elsewhere.
We live in a bacterial world. They're all around us. There are 2,000 different types of salmonella. But like all things with bacteria, they evolve and change, and some of them have become more virulent. They become nastier. They cause more bloodstream infections. In this particular outbreak that's the center of our film tonight, 15% of the people that got sick developed bloodstream infections, not just food poisoning, but bloodstream infections from the salmonella. Usually in such an outbreak, it's 5%. In this outbreak, 40% of the people were hospitalized. That's twice the usual rate of 20%. So some of these bacteria get to be nasty.
And these nasty bacteria, how common, these nasty versions of salmonella, how common are they in American poultry?
Well, salmonella is endemic in poultry, okay? The birds have it from the time they're born. It's in the hatcheries. It's on the farms, in the chicken houses. When they come into the slaughterhouse, it's there. And it doesn't make the birds sick. But some variants of it can make us quite sick. So the real difficult trick here is, if we're going to be a country that loves animal protein, right, chicken is the number one meat. It's surpassed beef. 8.5 billion chickens are consumed in this country every year. If that's the situation, and we do it on an industrial scale, how do you control the salmonella, get the levels down in the factory so that when I reach for the chicken breasts or the chicken thighs in the grocery store in that plastic tray, there's not enough contamination to make me sick. You're never going to get completely rid of bacteria in raw meat, but this is a case where the levels were high enough to make people sick for a long period of time.
Now, I looked at an industry website today. They didn't specifically talk about your documentary, but the first thing that popped up was a statement that if you handle chicken, raw chicken, carefully, you cook it right, cook it to the right temperature, even though there might be salmonella on it, there's nothing to worry about. As I understand from your Frontline documentary, that is basically the state of the law, too. It says, hey, consumers are smart. They know to cook their chicken. Let's not worry about that. How true is that?
Well, the courts have said this in a court ruling in 1974, that salmonella should not be considered an adulterant in poultry because housewives know how to deal with it. If you labeled it an adulterant or a specific strain as an adulterant, then it would be prohibited. And the producers would be told, you've got to get it out of your chicken. And if it was in chicken, it would have to be recalled immediately. But it's not an adulterant under current law. And therefore, these facilities that were producing chicken that made so many people sick, they were passing the tests that the Agriculture Department was conducting. There's a disconnect here. How could it be that these factories were passing the tests when 600 people over more than a year were coming to hospitals and doctors and saying, I'm sick from this? Something was wrong.
We're talking to David Hoffman, documentary filmmaker behind The Trouble with Chicken. That airs tonight at 9 on local public TV stations. So looking at this case, this Foster Farms case, people getting sick, state health inspectors trying to figure it out. They trace it back to this company. What happened next? Was there a recall? How quickly was action taken?
You know, there was a similar outbreak in 2011 at another company called Cargill. Cargill immediately, pretty quickly, recalled the ground turkey. It was the same Salmonella Heidelberg. Somebody died in that outbreak, but they recalled it, 36 million pounds. They closed down that factory to clean it out. They put those people out of work for a while. They took quick action. Now, compare that with what happened here. Foster Farms is the major poultry producer on the West Coast. There were at least three plants that were pinpointed by public health officials. The chicken was being brought to the market day after day and week after week. No recall. The company did not initiate a recall. The federal government had inspectors in those plants, and they did not press Foster Farms for recall, saying they didn't have the authority. So a long period went by of passivity, of inaction. In October of 2013, 9 months into this outbreak, the federal government issued a warning letter, a letter.
So are there lessons learned since then? Are things changing? Are states' health inspectors getting what they're looking for from regulators and from the poultry industry?
Well, I think one of the big gaps that we discovered in the film was that the federal government was testing for salmonella in some of these factories by checking whole chickens, whole broilers. And the problem was coming from cut-up parts, you know, the chicken breasts and thighs and legs that we buy. And, you know, by just checking the whole chicken, there are a lot of Americans. I think 80% of the chicken sold in the United States is sold as parts. So just recently, the Agriculture Department announced that they were going to put out limits for how much salmonella could be on parts. But up until now, parts were, you know, unchecked, and that was a mistake. They learned from that, I think. I think a lesson is that they have a big problem. When you cut the chicken up, you release some of the salmonella. They're going to try and do something, but the truth is salmonellosis, the illness from salmonella, has been plateaued. It has not gone down for years. The government has set targets saying we've got to reduce this. They've been unable to meet any of their targets. They've been unable to bring the illness down. And by saying we're going to set limits in the factories, they set the limits, the factories pass their tests, and people continue to get sick. There's a big disconnect here between what the Agriculture Department says they're doing and what's happening to public health. And the point of this film is to say, if people are getting sick, we have a problem.
D. David, I on a personal level, I mean, when you watch something like this, the natural question is, do I continue to eat these products, these chicken products, unless something changes? How did you come out of this? Is this something you would eat, something you'd cook up and serve to people?
I eat chicken, and I like chicken, but I treat raw chicken with great respect and cook it all the way to 165 degrees for sure. By the way, I don't think very many people like undercooked chicken. That's not the problem. The problem is the handling in the kitchen. You don't wash your chicken. If you wash it, you will splatter the salmonella bacteria around the sink. Many people make mistakes with the cutting board, with the knife, and that's where the problem lies. So I would say treat it very carefully. Cook it well.
David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was documentary filmmaker David Hoffman. His Frontline documentary, The Trouble with Chicken, airs tonight at 9 on your local public television station.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This afternoon, Dane County District Attorney Ishmael Ozan announced a decision to not charge Madison Police Officer Matt Kenny. The decision centers on events in March. That's when Officer Kenny shot and killed Tony Robinson, an unarmed black 19-year-old.
Officers were called to the scene on the east side of Madison because of reports that a man was running in and out of traffic and had assaulted two people. Police say Robinson assaulted Kenny before the officer shot him multiple times. Robinson's friends say he had taken hallucinogenic drugs on the day of his death and posed no threat to the officer.
The death of Tony Robinson sparked emotional protests across Madison and added fuel to the national conversation about the relationship between police and minority communities in the United States.
We have two guests with us to give their reaction to the DA's decision not to charge the Madison police officer who shot and killed Tony Robinson, an unarmed black 19-year-old. First, we'll talk to Brandy Grayson, a community activist with the Young, Gifted, and Black Coalition. And then we talk with Jim Palmer, executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Association, Professional Police Association, and attorney for Officer Matt Kenny. Brandy Grayson is with us first. Brandy, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, Brandy, what was your initial reaction to DA Ishmael Ozan's announcement that he's not going to charge Officer Matt Kenny?
Well, as YGB has been saying since the beginning, since March 6th, when Tony Robinson was assassinated by Matt Kenny, was that we were expecting a non-charge, non-indictment, no nothing. It goes along with what's been happening across our nation. It goes along with the attitude of our country relating to black and brown bodies, that the value of our life is less than the value of property. We understand that. We understood that. And the DA attempted to justify his decision by trying to connect with his blackness, and he failed. He started off saying, I'm a black man, I'm this, I'm that, but you're not. He's not. He doesn't live in the same reality. He doesn't live in the same circle. He doesn't navigate through the world the way we do. And we also understand that state violence, including the murder and assassination of our children in the streets, which is occurring every 8 hours since March. Think about that. One of us dies at the hands of a police or security officer every 8 hours. So we already understood from the beginning that there will be no justice. We understand that we must fight for justice. We must continue to be disruptive in the street. We must continue to put pressure. We must continue to educate our communities and our youth to understanding the implications of what is happening and the implications of his decision to not charge an officer who fatally shot and killed an unarmed child, regardless if he was on drugs. We've seen and witnesses throughout our country, different situations where white folks have guns and they're talked down, where white folks attempt to attack an officer or another person and they're not murdered. We just saw it recently in Madison where a white guy was going up with a fake gun or a pistol charging people. Literally charging people and frightening them. They did not kill him and shoot him.
Now, back to the case today. Do you expect civil charges to be filed now that we know criminal charges will not be?
Of course. They always do, right? Because that's the only justice people can get is, hey, be quiet. Here's a little money. Hope that comforts you and your family and your law. So, yeah, that's expected.
Now, the Wisconsin Police Union issued a bit of a statement. I'm going to paraphrase just a little bit of it, saying that now that this decision has come down, we need to strengthen the relationship between law enforcement and the city and those that the law represents and serves, and that Wisconsin can be a trailblazer, can provide a sort of a template for the rest of the nation. Do you agree with that?
I'm going to say this. I'm going to say that the template that they're quoting came from my quote from Disruptive Active article in Madison Magazine, in which I said and stated that the only way that we can become a trailblazer is if we're willing to do radical reform, if we're willing to actually address the root causes. Because all of us have great intentions. So, plenty of white liberals and white police officers and people in power and positions come together and say, hey, let's help out these black folks. Let's do this and do that. But they look at their intention and not the impact of their decisions. There's no way that we can formulate a relationship between law officers and like a Madison Police Department when they mock us, dismiss us, and straight tell us the more pressure you put on us, the more then you deserve whatever happens to you. That's exactly the quote from Chief Koval. So do we have faith that they will actually cultivate a relationship with the black and brown community? Heck no. It's structured and founded in racism. Remember, we are America. Remember, America is built on the backs of the genocide of one race and the enslavement of another. So we understand that structural racism is intertwined in everything. And all systems and all policies and all legislative processes. And this is not about relationships. This is about power. The power that the police have to kill us, to murder us, to assassinate us in the street without consequence. This is about power. So what YGB is demanding is that we have community control over policing. That's the only way they can cultivate a relationship with the black and brown community, by shifting power from the state to the people, where the people have the right and the ability to hire and fire, to set priorities and policies and procedures as we see fit for our communities and our neighborhoods. So if they want to cultivate a relationship with black and brown people, then they're going to have to give up some of their power. But there's one thing if a person wants to lynch me, doesn't matter to me if you want to lynch me. It's another thing when you have the power to do so without consequence. And that is the issue with the relationship between black and brown people and police officers.
Now, what you're describing is an enormous sea change going forward. And Michael Johnson, CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Dane County, has been doing some tweeting, calling this a defining moment for Madison. How would you like this moment to unfold for young, gifted, and black, and for the city at large?
Well, I'm not sure what that tweet means or what your purpose was bringing up his tweet. I'm not sure. But, you know, where we stand, YGB stands, versus where everybody else stands is not the same. We are a grassroots organization. We come from the streets. We operate in the streets. We're from the streets. We operate in our communities. We knock on doors. We canvass. We hold political education forums. We provide education. We give our children knowledge. We're different than Michael Johnson. We do not operate from the level of systematic control. No one's going to dictate how we proceed. No one's going to dictate how we operate, because we are the people. We represent the people. We represent the voiceless. So the way that we move is going to be totally different than the way anybody else has moved, because we must understand that in order to address the issues that Dane County faces and racial disparities with mass incarceration, the high disparities in education and every other system and category, if we're going to make real changes, then we may need to make radical changes. It's the same thing that happened during Martin Luther King time, right? No one thought it was possible to end Jim Crow. No one thought it was possible to end chattel slavery. And now we're fighting to end the power that police officers have and police districts have over our people and our community. It's the same thing, different faith. So no, I don't know if this is a defining moment. Defining moment for who? Will Madison move in the right direction? Because it's the same conversation we were indulging in 1983, and it's the same conversation we're having in 2005. So are we progressing or are we regressing? That really is the question.
Now, Young, Gifted, and Black has said it will not be staging protests today, that those protests will come tomorrow. What do you anticipate for tomorrow, and what is your goal? What do you want people to take away from what happens tomorrow?
Our goal is to shut down the streets. That's our goal. Do what we always do, disrupt things, shut down the streets. So the whole purpose is to make people aware of the climate, to make people aware of what's happening to black people in Madison and Dane County and the state and in the country. We're all living the same reality when you're black and brown and you grow up in certain neighborhoods and communities, right? So our job is to get in the streets, stay in the streets, build a base, increase our base, develop allies, stand in solidarity, put pressure where pressure needs to be, and to say that we're not going anywhere. Our actions will last forever. You know, like we understand that the struggle for black liberation is a struggle for generations. So we are focused on developing our leaders, developing our youth to understand the implications of what's happening right now, the political implications of what's happening right now, So tomorrow you will see us in the street starting at 9 a.m. Tomorrow for us is Blackout Wednesday, meaning no school, no work, no nothing. Come join us in the street. Come eat, come laugh, come enjoy some music, come enjoy some education, and let Madison and local officials know that we demand justice for Tony, even if the DA was not courageous enough to charge Matt Kinney with murder of one of our children. We will not take that as the final answer. That will not be our final answer.
Brandy, thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem. Have a good day.
You too. That was Brandy Grayson, community organizer with the Young, Gifted, and Black Coalition. And now we turn to Jim Palmer for reaction to the DA's decision to not charge Officer Matt Kinney. Jim Palmer is the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association and attorney for Matt Kinney. Jim Palmer, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Jim, what was your initial reaction to DA Ishmael Ozan's announcement that he will not charge Officer Kinney?
Well, it's the right result. And, you know, it is at the end of an extensive and exhaustive independent and transparent investigation, which is mandated by a state law that no other state in the nation has. And so, you know, we always felt as though Officer Kinney's actions were within the bounds of the law and his training and departmental policies. And it was good to hear, you know, after such an extensive investigation that included evidence to which we were not privy, that in fact was the right lawful result.
We got word that the lawful use, that there was lawful use of deadly force. But a larger question, as referenced by one of our earlier guests today, a law professor, was that use of force appropriate? Was that the time to be using it? Are those questions that will be looked at more closely, not again in the arena of criminal charges, but maybe in the Department of Police procedures and policies?
Yeah, absolutely. I think anytime there's a situation involving a law enforcement's use of force or any high-profile incident, law enforcement, regardless of where you are around Wisconsin, around the country, it reflects, it takes a look and examines its policies, and it is always looking to improve and grow, and certainly that will be the case here. You know, it's not lost on any Madison police officer, and certainly not Officer Kinney, that a family here has suffered a tragic loss. And you know, so even though this is the appropriate legal conclusion based upon the specific facts at hand and the law, it doesn't change the fact that a family has suffered a loss, and that's something that, you know, our hearts go out to the Robinson family for that reason.
Now, the Robinson family said, according to their privately conducted autopsy, that a bullet left Robinson's chest, suggesting to them that he was shot in the back. Now, that not being what we heard today at the press conference with Ishmael Ozan, what do you make of that discrepancy in the report?
Well, I haven't been privy to either one, frankly. I haven't seen the official autopsy. It seemed pretty clear from the district attorney's decision that that simply was not the case. The family, I know they've indicated that they do have a private autopsy, but they haven't released any of that. And now, because of the district attorney's decision today, all the investigative documents and reports will be in the public view. And that, again, is as a result of a law that Wisconsin has that no other state in the nation has. And so that is something that we can continue to, you know, engage in a community-wide discourse and explore ways to strengthen not only the relationship between law enforcement officers and the public that they serve, but we can, you know, find ways to better serve the public. And at the same time, hopefully, that discussion, that discourse can serve as a platform that you know, members of the public can become a little more informed about law enforcement practices, because they are complicated issues. And I think we have an opportunity here to grab in Wisconsin and to really make something productive from this tragedy, and hopefully that we take advantage of that.
How soon do you think the Madison Police Department will be following up with its own investigation on whether or not Kinney followed police policies?
I couldn't say. I'm not sure, really, frankly, how long that will take. We would expect that just like today, that he will be found to have acted accordingly, acted within his proper, you know, his training and his departmental policies. And Officer Kinney is eager to get back to work. He is a deep and genuine affection for this community and for serving and helping people, and that is something to which he is looking to return as soon as he can.
Now, some of Madison's community leaders have talked about changing police training, changing procedure in light of the death of Tony Robinson. Do you see that happening, and what would it take?
Well, I think we have an opportunity here in Wisconsin and certainly in the city of Madison to have a, you know, to use the investigative documents that are going to be made public, to engage in a public, you know, discussion with the community and, to explore ways that those things can be improved. The fact of the matter is that the legal standard by which officers are evaluated when it comes to their use of lethal force is established by the United States Supreme Court, and that was going back to 1989. So, certainly, there are things that changes that can be made to some policies and to departmental training. Madison and Wisconsin, in general, our officers and our departments are ahead of the curve when it comes to community-oriented policing. When it comes to mental health training, just in fact, last week I was up in La Crosse, and officers put their mental health training to work there to talk a suicidal victim, rescue a suicidal victim off of one of their main bridges, and so. You know, we have an opportunity to grow as a profession and to grow and strengthen the relationship between law enforcement officers and the public, and I think we're certainly going to want to take part in that, and we hope there'll be a lot of people, you know, that want to come to the table and have that discussion.
Jim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Jim Palmer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association and the lawyer for Officer Matt Kenny. He was with us to give us his reaction to DA Ishmael Ozan's decision not to charge Officer Matt Kenny in the shooting death of Tony Robinson. Before we spoke with him, we got reaction from Brandy Grayson with the Young, Gifted, and Black Coalition. We're continuing our conversation now about the Dane County District Attorney Ishmael Ozan's decision not to charge Madison Police Officer Matt Kenny. In March, Officer Kenny shot and killed Tony Robinson, an unarmed 19-year-old black man.
What do you think of the decision? What is your reaction? Did you hope it would be different, or was it the right call? How do you hope to see the community move forward, and how do you hope to see police relations with minority communities move forward in the future? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we begin by listening to a clip from District Attorney Ishmael Ozan about how he reached his decision, setting up the framework. Here he is.
My decision will not end the racial disparities that exist in the justice system, in our justice system. My decision is not based on emotion. Rather, this decision is based on the facts as they have been investigated and reported to me. This decision is guided by the rule of law and the oath I took to uphold the Constitution.
And that decision, he's referencing the decision not to press criminal charges against Madison Police Officer Matt Kenny. We go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Therese is first in Superior. Hi, Therese.
Hi. I just wanted to say that the officer said that he was afraid that that boy that he was accosting would take his weapon and kill him. So he knew that that boy did not have a weapon, according to what he said. So I just question that.
All right. Thank you, Therese. And there was conversation in Ishmael Ozan's ruling about the perception of the threat, Officer Kenny, and his opinion that his gun could be taken from him if he lost consciousness. We'll go next to Michael in Milwaukee. Michael, hi.
Hi. A couple of things. As I told the screener, first of all, I don't know how we got everything screwed up where the conversation tends to go in the direction that the police are the bad guys. No, the police are the good guys, and they're doing a difficult job that nobody wants to do. And it isn't always a pretty job, but it's got to be done. Another thing that I told the screeners, the fact that I'm a longtime public radio listener, but I am so angry at public radio for the way they portray these stories. And they skew this story. Every time they mention one of these shooting stories, they always say unarmed. Unarmed has nothing to do with the decision or whether to use deadly force or not. A police officer is not Hulk Hogan. A police officer is not a big-time wrestler or something. They can easily be killed by somebody that doesn't have a weapon. The weapon has nothing to do with it, and especially in close quarters, especially when they're wrestling and fighting with suspects who are high on drugs and who have superhuman strength.
And, Michael, I want to hear you out just briefly because we have other callers to get to, but other than not mentioning whether or not someone was armed, are there other changes that you would like to hear?
Well, the other thing is, too, is the other thing that's skewed up in this is I live in Milwaukee. I tell you, I'm 69 years old. I've been around the city for a long time. And one of the problems that the black community has is they cannot say when one of their people is doing something actually wrong. And that this person that actually got shot by the police, you know what? He was really screwing around and doing something crazy, and if he would be obeying the law, it wouldn't escalate to these things. But
Michael, thank you so much for sharing your opinions. Appreciate you calling us up today. We're going to go next to Ray joining us in Racine. Ray, hi.
Hi. I will be forthright and just letting you guys know that I had to disguise my name and where I'm from because I'm currently in the running for, there's 35 positions available in the city of Milwaukee right now for a police officer. And I'm also African-American, and I graduated with a degree in criminal justice law enforcement here in the city of Milwaukee. And I just want to be very honest with you guys and let you know that there are things that officers face that people who have not been trained in criminal justice law enforcement understand. People talk, say things that to me are just completely outlandish and ridiculous. Like, why don't you, you know, shoot someone in the leg or shoot someone in the knee or shoot someone in the arm to stop them? Why do you have to shoot to kill? That's one example of that, something that kind of armchair pundits say.
And Ray, based on your training, why is that a naive thing in your opinion to say?
Well, for one, we're trained to stop the threat, and stopping the threat is really a euphemism for trained to kill. Trained to kill. You can't stop the threat by shooting someone in the leg or in the arm. Someone can still harm you. Someone could have a weapon on them. Someone can have a concealed weapon and then out of nowhere produce that weapon when you think that you've just stopped them by shooting them in the leg or the arm. That person could even be empowered with adrenaline enough to grab your weapon after you think you've stopped them by shooting them in the arm or the leg. I really understand exactly what was going on with that officer when he was faced with that young man that was, I'm sorry for lack of a better word, just like hopped up on some sort of hallucinogen.
And Ray, I'm going to stop you there so we can get to another quick caller. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. And we're going to go next to John in Grand Rapids. John, a quick comment from you.
Hi, and you know, I can't believe someone would make a blanket statement that all cops are good. That seems ridiculous to me, and certainly we understand most or overwhelming majority are. But that doesn't mean things go wrong. And in this case, I'm wondering, what is the policy? You know this guy's darting in and out of traffic and behaving erratically, which might kind of give you an indication that he's on drugs. If you don't see an imminent danger when you get to the scene, why are you going right up into that guy's face and getting him going? He came out attacking. Why aren't you waiting for backup? What is the policy on that matter?
And, John, thank you so much for your call. Thank you, everyone. And you can keep the conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page, or you can find us on Twitter. We are @CentralTimeWPR.